Okay, let's start. The topics for the last hour here now will be, I'll talk a little bit about service and make that into a bridge towards the representativeness of samples. Won't go very much into detail here, but because I will also in the end present at least one of the papers that you're going to use as a background for your analysis of or your writing the first essay. So, surveys. Let me just find the application here. I'm jumping something in the presentation here now, but I'll use the skip slides later. Service is the term we use for handing out questionnaires or asking a very structured set of questions where you want to measure something that's out there now. You want to measure the states of affairs, so to speak. A method that a lot of you will use at some level in some projects later. In this topic or in scientific methodology, but also maybe in your master thesis as some kind of a background for the thesis you're going to do. Surveys can be a lot of things. Ranges all the way from personal one face-to-face interviews where you formulate all the questions and write down the responses to the most common form, which we also have some fatigue towards, and that's all the polls that you are being asked to take part in on the net all the time. Of course, a convenient way of doing things, but also a somewhat problematic method, as we'll get back to. In between all these, you have different ways to perform a survey. Once upon a time, telephone interviews were performed, not so much anymore. Also have to do with some fatigue, I think. A lot of people don't take the phones anymore. They just want to find out who calls first. You have the possibility of mail, meaning everything from snail mail, ordinary, posting a questionnaire to a named person. Of course, also involving electronic ways of doing the same. So there are a number of ways to do this, and of course, one of the arguments for going down on that list and perform things electronically. I'm not using this to disencourage you of doing electronic research, by the way, just to make you think about other possibilities now and then. But of course, one of the main advantages has to do with cost and access to a wide audience. So you can actually reach a lot of people in a very convenient way for you, and also maybe in a convenient way for the respondents, so that it's easy for them to give responses. So it has a lot of cost and resource arguments in favor of it. There are a number of disadvantages as well, because it's maybe not such a big issue as we are aware of this now, but once at least privacy was a major thing here. Just in case there are sounds here, I'll do this. So privacy and anonymity at least was an issue. It is still somewhat an issue as some of the most commonly used tools for handing out questionnaires. I'm giving one example is Questback, which you may have heard of, but also I think Google has one that's open as well. These sample IP addresses, for instance. So they make that as part of the information gathering to make sure that people don't, that not the same person gives responses over and over again. So it has its reasons, but it also has some challenges to it, because if you really want to do it, you can find out who gives what responses. So there are issues here, but not that much anymore, because we are aware of this, so we try to block this from the end user, or from us as. So it's a filter that the tool uses to make sure that you get unique respondents, but they don't necessarily log it, so you can go back to it. But the main issue and problem when it comes to using electronic surveys has to do with response rates and the type of respondents that you get when you do this type of studies. Well, in the old days, when you did when the National Census Bureau did studies in the Norwegian population with named lists of respondents and the questionnaire you had to send back, you got it in the mail and you had to send it back, you usually got response rates of 80% or around that. So most respondents responded, and you could be pretty sure that you got a representative sample of your population. A more normal response rate today, if you just send out questionnaires, even if you send it out and invite people, is maybe less than 10%. So even though it's easy to reach a huge population, you can't expect to get a lot of responses. And as we'll come back to, there is also some concerns about the representativity of those who respond on electronic questionnaires. Because of course, if you want to say something about the population, you want to make sure that you actually have the correct population so that you can infer that the responses you get are the correct ones. Excuse me. One old example here illustrates this in a pretty good way. And it's used quite a lot when we are discussing how to understand the responses that you get. Way back, 1936, the science of doing surveys and doing statistics on surveys was still quite young. Anyone knew quite, didn't know that much about it. Still, these types of studies were performed. And a big magazine, Literary Digest magazine, they did a poll that wanted to investigate the or try to say something about the outcome of a presidential election back in 1936. It was a really huge study, compared to any type of study that we will do today. 2.4 million voters took part in this poll. So a really huge number, or at least were invited to take part. The study predicted that the Republican Party's Landon would get 57% of the votes, and Roosevelt would only get 43%. So they predicted an overwhelming majority towards the Republican candidate in this setting. What happened was that only weeks after they published this thing, well, Roosevelt won a landslide of an election. He got 62% of the votes in the end. So a huge margin the other way. So what did go wrong here? I can just give you a little bit about the method that they used first. They actually asked, they send these requests to a huge database of recipients. And their sampling method, the way of finding people to invite to this study, was to go through phone registers. So they had a database, even back then, I think. Maybe it was, I don't know how they handled databases back then. But at least they had phone registers with up to 11 million households registered. So they picked from that list. They picked from car owners' registers that they had access to. They picked from membership lists in organizations that they had access to, among them their own readers. And I said just 2.4 million of the 10 that were invited took part actually in the poll. But just still, it's 25% of the population that they invited. So it's a pretty huge number of respondents that they had here. But they predicted wrong. What did go wrong here? What do you think? Any suggestions? How could they fail? Any suggestions? Yeah, maybe some of the databases were biased here. I can't give an answer whether that is the case. But what I can say is that you're on the right track here. Of course, there are some biases in the bases here, because back in 1936, who owned telephones and who owned cars? They were probably middle class to upper middle class and above. And who were most likely to vote Republican? Probably the same group. So they got a very biased selection, even though the selection was really huge in this case. So the message here is numbers is not the way to solve representativity issues in surveys. You can't compensate for biases in your selection by adding up higher numbers. Let's jump to this one. We have these types of television programs that asks these nice questions to you. I'm not sure if it's that common anymore. It was just a few years ago, where you get these pointed questions. What do you think? And then you get an easy question in the bottom of the screen. In this case, should Norway close their borders for refugees from distant countries. Do you agree or disagree? It's a pretty easy question, right? Two answers. And in this program, 40,000 people voted during the little hour they had to give their votes for this question. 40,000 phoned in and gave their votes. And nearly 90% agreed in the question. Yes, we should close our borders. So, of course, it's not a valid conclusion. It's not so that 90% of the Norwegian population means this. Because when a professional census bureau like Opinion asked the same question, but also included a not sure category, and mailed this or invited 600 respondents to give the same response to a similar question, even though they had the not sure thing. Well, it was the other way around. 16% agreed. 75% disagreed. So it was completely turned around. Which one is correct, do you think? The 40,000 or the 600? It's pretty obvious, right? And what do you think is the what is the cause of this discrepancy? Why does this happen? Yes. What you're pointing at is the problem of self-selection. You tend to give your response only towards things that you have a strong opinion towards. And in this case, this weighted for agreeing to this first question. So the more likely, the more interested you are in this topic, well, the more likely you probably were to watch this TV program as well. So that's an additional bias here. People that weren't that interested in questions like this don't follow these types of programs. So self-selection is a major problem in surveys, or in any type of study where you want to have someone to be representative of a larger population. And remember the same thing when you do internet surveys, for instance. The only ones, I'm a bit square in the formulation now, the only ones that's likely to answer these questions are people that have strong opinions or interests in the field that you are investigating. So this is a major threat towards validity of this type of studies, where you don't have a good selection process or a good sampling process. You only have somewhat an arbitrary way of sampling people or inviting people to take part in your study. So numbers is really not important here, or large numbers is not the strategy. So if you know your population, you can limit things down quite a lot. For instance, you gain very little in most studies by having a larger group of respondents than, well, let's say about 400. These are just rules of the thumb. The numbers that I show up here. If you have a small population, well, you want to have most of them invited and most of them to take part in the study. So if you have a really small population, don't bother with processes or procedures for making a sample representative. But if you have a larger population, well, let's say over 500, try to get 50% of them in your list. If you have 1,500, try to have one of five represented, and this number drops. And it's little gain to have more than 400 or 500. In some of these big census studies where you ask people about political opinions, for instance, you have a pretty consistent sample of some 400 or 500 respondents. But as long as they know them well and that you know how representative they are, these will give you pretty accurate numbers in the end. So it's little to gain to just increase numbers, because some of the problems will just increase. You can say when it comes to sampling, we have two major strategies to sample. One is called probability sampling, and one is called non-probability sampling. And the ideal situation is that you can do what's called probability sampling, meaning that every member of a population we want to say something about have the same given chance to be part of the study. So if you want to know something about the Norwegian population or the population of students at the Gjøvik, well, then we must make sure that any of you, all of you, have just the same chance of being picked as a respondent and picked for an interview. That's doing a random sampling based on probability methods. When you know a little bit more about the population, you can be more strategic towards the same and do what's called stratified sampling. Well, you know that in our population there are some 60% boys and 40% girls or something like that. We'll make sure that that's also represented in the end population. So control for these factors and pick 60% boys and 40% girls could probably be handled in this case by the random method itself. But maybe when you have more divided subpopulations, you want some of the old students represented and some of the young students, or you want to make sure that people from different study programs are represented or different campuses are represented, for instance, well, then you do this in a stratified way. So you balance populations in that way. This is then contrasted to what we call non-probability methods. The ideal is to make or to do probability sampling. And whenever you have the possibility to do that, whenever you have some kind of a database, that's the ideal situation. And that's what you should do. In most cases, you don't have that. But then you do as well as you can. This is often referred to as convenience sampling. Well, you get access to those you have access to. In your case, maybe friend lists or member lists on Facebook or in other settings. Well, then you invite participants from there. But you have a lot of challenges if you do that with representativity. There's also some other strategies, so you can read more about the details of these different methods. It's well explained in your course book. But one I will point to is and which may be relevant for some of you in studies, is what's called snowball sampling. It's not a very common method, or you could say, but it's highly relevant for a lot of the stuff many of you do when you want to isolate. Let's say that you want to investigate what drives people who plays World of Warcraft or that type of games. a lot, let's say spend 6 hours a day or 8 hours a day doing that. There may be people here who does that, I'm not sure, or have done it, or whatever. The point with, if you just ask a general population about this, you probably won't, the chance of hitting the one of you who actually do this, or the three or five of you, I don't know, maybe this is not the right population to have as an example, but the chance of getting that using a broad method, asking a lot of people, is quite small. So what you tend to do in snowball sampling is that you identify one, and then you take the one and asks his network, and then their network again, so that you get a pretty good sample of the population you're after. So this is useful when you have subpopulations that's not that well represented in the general population. So it's a strategy. Okay, let me use the last 15 minutes to present one of the papers that you are going to analyze. Okay, that was not good. Then we probably lost some of the recording here. That's not good, but I'll... At least we can take the final part here. Like that, and then we can go to this one. As you have seen in the Blackboard now, under this content of the for the course, there is a folder called files for this project, and in there you can find the two papers that I want you to analyze. One of them is picked from something called the Journal of Improbable Research. It could be a good idea to spend some time searching for other articles there. There are a lot of interesting studies. So, does actually a cat fall down on his legs when it's dropped? Kind of challenging ethically, but it's done. And it's typically studies that's done by scientists on funny topics, but now and then done in a very structured and good way, and described in a scientific context. So the first of these papers was such a paper, where they are trying to investigate a common saying, namely that Kansas, the state of Kansas, is flatter than a pancake. We probably have some formulations like this of parts of Norway as well. Jern or something. But it's pretty clear. It has pretty clear variables, and it's pretty, should be pretty okay to analyze. I've also included a paper that I took part in, among others, a study where two of my colleagues went to some course of pedagogics, and they wanted to investigate some topic that was of concern to them. And based on this study, we wrote a small paper. not necessarily a very good study. I have to be honest to say that. But it may be possible to analyze it, so feel free to criticize this as well. Its focus was, well, what we call it was, and this was done a few years ago, so it also caught on to some major changes in technologies. But we wanted to see whether people's use of internet-connected devices, we were focusing on laptops, of course, when we did this the first time, does that affect the learning outcomes, or does that affect an audience here? Some third of you or something here in class now have laptops open, but some may also have other devices, which is one of the changes that has taken place. So yeah, we know that you access the net and we can't block it, so this is the basics. There are a lot of worries among teachers on whether that this actually distracts more than it helps. Some of us are quite conservative. We want you to write things with paper and pen still. But it may also support learning. And we did this study in this context. So how do people use it, and how do they perceive the usage of computers during lectures? The procedure was that we gave a questionnaire as a surprise after an ordinary lecture, or several ordinary lectures. So the administrators of these questionnaires, they were sitting silently in the back of the classroom, and in the end of the lecture, they administered this questionnaire, which was slightly different from for the users of laptops compared to those who didn't use laptops. Questions were almost similar, but not absolutely similar. Because in one case, we asked, what did you do? And the other case was questions that had to do with what did you observe others to do? So that was the major difference. 210 students in 8 lectures, mostly males. Out of these, actually, 73 used PCs and 137 didn't, so approximately one third, which roughly I think reflects what we see in the class here today. In our case, it varied quite a lot. We had classes with one or two users, and we had classes with a huge number of users. And you can, of course, think what type of classes that was. We did something at the health department here and something here for IT students. We did this in 2 occasions. It was done in 2007 and again in 2011. So we did this at 2 occasions, and the you could say that was one of the things we were after. Had things changed during these years? And actually it did. So, as I said, we asked about what they did. But we also asked about their attitudes towards computer using and different types of computer usage during class. In the analysis of this, we specified that we wanted to look at what we called academic relevant activities. So what people did or was observed doing was grouped into academic relevant activities, like looking at a web page for the course, or downloading the PowerPoints or something like that, following course pages, the learning management systems, looking at web pages that was referred to. That was classed as academic relevant activities, while browsing news, Facebook, mail, YouTube, gaming, all these activities were classified as non-academic activities. 2007 was, by the way, somewhat pre-Facebook. So maybe that's something that has changed things a lot as well. As one of the topics we investigated was, of course, some demographics or some background things, usage in general. From 2007 to 2011, well, we measured a slight increase in usage. Actually, not significant. There was an increase. But the important thing here is to see that even though people had computers, because that's the major thing in the second point here, even though people had computers, they did not use them during class. Because one of the things that had changed quite a lot since from 2007 to 2011 was that even though people had that's what's in the next slide, by the way, the major change was that in 2007 people could say that, well, I don't use computers in class because I haven't got it, I haven't access to a device like this. In 2011, this group had disappeared completely. So all students, or almost all students, this is the first thing here, had access. So none of them actually said that they didn't use it because they didn't have access to it. The reason they didn't use it was that they perceived it as not necessary. It didn't give any advantage. And most people, even though they had access to it, did not use it. So still 60%, and it seems to be keeping up, don't use it. Maybe it's because we don't encourage it in a good way. I'm not sure. What we did find was that the more likely you are to be a heavy computer user off class, the more likely you were to use computers in class. And that was strongly significant. So the more you tended to use computers in your everyday life, the more likely you were to use it in class. So no big surprise here. What we did find, and this was the major finding, was kind of interesting. There was a very obvious discrepancy between observers and users of PCs when they reported what they were actually doing, when things were divided into academic here in blue and non-academic activities in green. So computer users reported that they spent more than medium time on academic activities, while non-users observed more time on non-academic activities. So how do we explain this? People or computer users say that they actually use computers for relevant things during class, while the observers say something else. I can't say what's true or not, and this is what we discuss here. Maybe the true answer is the answer from the computer users, that they mainly use computers for academically relevant activities. Maybe. But even if that's the case, some of the activities that they are observed doing, even though it's just small things, catches a lot of attention, and that's what we call visual noise here. So irrelevant use, playing a small game, watching a video, browsing news pages or looking at funny news, even though it's only a small portion of what's being done in class, those activities catches a lot of attention. That was our learning from this. So it acts as noise during class. You can see the numbers in the paper that's in there. So these were our conclusions. Academic irrelevant use of internet during lectures works as an attention grabber. It catches a lot of attention. We also took the freedom to try to generalize that this is also the case for other arenas, like open office landscapes, like meeting rooms, social situations. Computers are ubiquitous, they are everywhere, and even more so when computers are put in our pockets. So they are everywhere, so we can't forbid it. We need to discuss culture. So the way we use things is important, not that we have access to it. So that was some serious notes in the end here. And that was the one of the papers I want you to analyze. Okay, no lecture next week. Deliver your essay before Friday. Or during Friday, I'm not sure when I set. I think I set midnight or something. So you have Friday to deliver. And you will get a second chance. So don't worry too much, but do your best so you don't have to rewrite it. Okay? Thanks.